Good evening and welcome to Screen Tone Club. This is episode 112 of your fortnightly manga discussion podcast. We are recording this on September the 11th, 2022, for release on 20th of September 2022. As October looks like it's going to be a hellish month for both of us, one of us more than the other, we figured we'd get we'd try and record earlier, so we'll see what happens. Trying to be responsible alongside me is Mr. Andy Hanley. How you doing, Andy?
Yeah, I'm feeling the pressure now. I'm expected to be responsible. Like, I'm not sure I'm ready for this.
Well, I mean, you know, both of us are, you know, adults, supposedly.
But, are we? Yeah. I mean, we're literally here to talk about comics, so.
Well, there's worse things to talk about, quite frankly, so hey. As mentioned, fortnightly manga podcast, we both go away, read a thing, come back, talk about it. Hooray! You can support us on Patreon if you do like what we're doing here with the whole reading of manga thing. Patreon.com/ScreenToneClub. Some of our listeners are in the shout-outs tier, and so get a little shout-out here. Mr. Rob Jessup, the blue-haired cyborg, and Seegers Gert are the cool people. Well, you're all cool, but, you know, these people are, you know, pay us money, more money, cool. We also have a Discord where cool people can hang out, link in the show notes. Anyway, let's talk about manga. Let's go for it. Do you mind if I take first stab, Andy?
Yeah, dealer's choice. I really want to talk about both of these, so let's,
let's go. So, yeah, I'm all electrified and ready to go. Anyway, let's put that one down. Anyway, my pick was Tesla Note, Volume 1. I kind of picked this up because, frankly, it was in a sale and, like, I had money burning a hole in my pocket, so let's buy a Volume 1 of Tesla Note. And the cover doesn't really give away too much with, like, the pair of main characters, Botan and Kurama. It's just like, oh, yeah, pair of people. But then I found out from reading a blurb on the back that one of the writers on it is the writer of Tiger and Bunny. And Tiger and Bunny at the moment, season 2, is in my, like, pile of shame because I need to go back to it despite professing an unending love for that series. Whoops. But anyway, authors of Tesla Note are Masafumi Nishida and Tadayoshi Kubo, and the artist is Kota Sanomiya. Published by Kodansha, it's complete in Japan at 7 volumes, which seems short for the scope of it, but we'll get to that. There are 5 of them out in English, and there's another volume coming at the end of this month, so shortly after this episode comes out. There is an anime. I haven't watched it. I meant to. Word on the grapevine that got to me is that it's a rather strange CG thing that I don't know if it quite matches the what is here, but hey, maybe I'll go take a look at that after this. It appears to be digital only. At the moment, I couldn't find a physical Dead Tree version, at least here in England. I don't know if you did, Andy.
No, I mean, to be fair, I rarely look these days, but it would make sense that at the very least this has been a kind of like digital first kind of title. I can totally see it fitting that mold for Kodansha.
Yeah, plus, you know, it's about Tesla, so it has to take the form of electrons. Anyway, I should stop making these bad jokes. So Tesla Note is actually, like, because it's been a, you know, much alongside zombies and Lovecraft, there's been a reevaluation and a re-sort of embracing among nerds, frankly, including some of the more sort of insufferable, like Elon Musk humpers out there, about Nikola Tesla, the sort of Eastern European genius inventor who had beef with Thomas Edison, mostly because Edison stole all his shit, and Edison also killed an elephant to try and prove Nick Tesla wrong, because that was fucked up. Read about that. It's a really interesting Wikipedia page about how an elephant got murdered. Poor thing. Anyway, Nikola Tesla is a prick. He found out a whole bunch of stuff, and then during World War II, a lot of powers came to him to was like, hey, how about some inventions we could do with those to, like, you know, Wolfenstein this up? And he said, oh, no, I'm not sure about that. I'm going to lock away all my knowledge in this crystal called the Tesla Note, title drop. And then he splits it up into, like, an indeterminate number of crystal fragments, all about sort of, like, hand high. And they've got a number on them, as it turns out. But apparently, these fragments are set to go haywire if anyone tries to, like, unlock them, which seems like an extremely questionable, like, safety mechanism. It's like, why would you make your magical future technology you're locking away for 100 years fail deadly? And if someone tries to touch them or interact with them, it just goes ham and, like, starts doing wacky shit. Like, I don't know about you, Andy, but that seems like a really, like, that sounds like a health and safety nightmare at the minimum.
Yeah, I mean, the typical thing in this scenario is you have some kind of self-destruct mechanism, but this seems to be more a destruct everything else other than the thing that is actually dangerous mechanism, which, yeah, questionable for sure.
Yeah, there's a lot of questions about this where people don't really seem to know how many fragments there are, what they actually do. Like, no one, he didn't leave behind a Tesla note, which explained what all of them did. And so this, we always talk about on this podcast, like the importance of a first panel, you know, get you in. And so this, this series opens with a train in Oslo teleporting and basically obliterating a lot of people on a busy intersection. And so, cut then to Japan, where you have quote unquote normal schoolgirl, Negatoro Botan, who actually isn't normal at all, because she's a ninja. She's a descendant of a ninja clan. Her granddad basically raised her to save the world in the future. And she is relieved, when she has come under and comes under attack by a pair of dudes in her house, because it finally means you can do, you can save the world and be a spy. And so she's part of like a weird, like, private company based in Japan that is trying to collect these fragments and keep them safe. And as you discover very quickly through this, there's a lot of other actors who want to get a hold of these things. And it appears that Tesla may have like sown his seeds widely and told quite a lot of people about them. And so now you have different groups of spies trying to get a hold of these things, these note crystal fragments, to use them for good or for ill. And so, yeah, you get quite a lot of interesting characters. There's at least two teams at the moment in this first volume who are vying for them. And of course, also there's the possibility that bystanders get involved, like Petta, this little sort of child of a native Norwegian lady and an immigrant father. Lady died, mum died, and so immigrant father gets shat on by everyone in a like disgusting display of racism, and the kid then goes out pickpocketing to help him survive. But he finds the crystal, and turns out it's got some powers that no one can really control that could be super are super bad. Enter Botan and new sort of friend slash frenemy slash teammate slash mortal enemy Kurama, who is a dude who is extremely insufferable because he goes on and on about his sense of justice, but also appears to be weirdly beefy and resilient. Like, he takes a punch like it ain't no thing. And also, like, kind of is an interesting character, even though he's a prick. Both of them also have beauty marks in different places, which, I don't know, I feel like the author is just, like, picking out beauty marks to be a sign of, like, weird powers. And anyway, so yeah, Botan and Kurama join up in Oslo to find out why the fuck this train teleported. Could it happen again? Is this a Tesla fragment? Spoilers, yes. And to try and get a hold of this fragment and keep it safe. And so yeah, that's kind of the like extremely long form version of the intro, but basically secret agents collect magical technology fragments. Check it out. Like, have some cool action scenes. And watch this like mismatched buddy cop team come together. Like these like kind of exhausting and full of himself dude and the closet and the rather sort of socially sheltered ninja who can't smile. But he's also cool. And also their handlers. So yeah, that's Tesla Note. What did you think about this, Andy?
Yeah, I mean, one of my early notes was, as I was working through this, is just all caps, why is so much happening? Because
very like, accurate.
Yeah, because like this series, like right from the get-go, it has so many concepts and ideas and things it wants to work with, and I kind of just wish all of them got a bit more time. Like right from the get-go, you know, when you meet Botan, who, by the way, you called her Botan Nagatoro earlier in this, and
now
that is the only series that I want of this, like Nagatoro is the protagonist here, just does some judo and teases people. But anyway, like, you know, you kind of her intro is kind of quite good in terms of kind of like quiet glasses wearing seemingly bookish girl, but suddenly like, oh no, she's a ninja. And like, that feels like that could have been a good chapter of just like, show me a bit more of this character and kind of, you know, the duality of, you know, who she pretends to be in her outside life and who she actually is. But all of that is kind of rushed in, and then it's suddenly like, oh, by the way, like, you know, there's this Japan Safety Promotion Limited, like, organization that is here to save the world. And that's kind of a throwaway thing. Like, you don't get a big, long kind of, you know, insight into how this company was kind of formed and all that kind of stuff. Like, you get little bits, kind of smatterings of it put in through this volume, but, like, that feels like that could have been a thing kind of like right from the get-go. And then, you know, you get Kurama, who, yeah, there's not really much explanation of his sort of backstory. He's just there and he's kind of a jerk. Then you have like the Kurama Botan relationship, which probably gets more play than most things in this volume, but it's still, I kind of feel like I'd like to see a bit more of that, or at least kind of a slightly different spin on that to give it a bit more focus. And then you have this whole, like, crystal thing and basically a plot that turns into, like, speed of just, like, if anything goes over 100 miles an hour, then it's going to be trouble. Which, again, like, there's a really good sort of end point to that in terms of a kind of, like, almost, it feels like it all gets a bit Mission Impossible-esque of just, like, yep, we've got to do this thing before this thing happens. And even that is kind of rushed through in such a way, like, that should be a really good, tense, you know, you're seeing the countdown really slowly, like, page by page, and it's slowly clicking up and ratcheting up of just, like, can they do this in time? Kind of knowing that this is volume one, and there are other volumes, surely they're going to. But, like, you can still build some, like, you know, you can still build something there. But, again, it kind of, it breezes through that so fast of just, like, boom, 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 and it's done. And that was kind of my thing here. Like, I feel like there are a lot of individual things where I'm like, I kind of like this, like, conceptually, but none of it settled for long enough for me to be like, oh, I'm kind of invested in this now.
Yeah, I gotta admit, all the things you just mentioned are reasons I love this series. Even the fact that it kind of barrels for everything. Admittedly, this is my second time reading it, so I got to luxuriate in it a bit more and kind of like know the broad strokes, and so I could take my time picking out the little bits and pieces I liked. But also, yeah, I really enjoy the fact that it kept moving. Like, you move from, you know, Nikola Tesla setting up landmines to Botan's weird sort of like realization that her granddad was not going senile and she is going to be a secret agent, to, hey, check it out, we're like a mythical future technology PMC limited by shares, ? To then, oh, we're in Oslo, oh shit, and things are already getting real, and oop. And yeah, and Mission Impossible is a real big touchstone for this, at least for myself. Like, it has that feeling of gotta move, like, we could sit you down and spend 4 pages gabbing about this, or we could carry on with the mission. And I'm like, yeah, cool. And, you know, it introduces like other parties who are interested in the fragments, and what's their deal, who knows. And it even has a literal Mission Impossible tear the fake face off panel, which frankly that will never get old for me. Maybe it's because I saw Mission Impossible at a tender age when I was, you know, impressionable, but the act of someone tearing off a fake face and going, ha ha, I have succeeded in my mission, will never get old to me. That shit rules.
Yeah, no, I'm with you on that. Like, yeah, Lupin the Third does that quite a lot as well, and it's pretty rad in that most of the time. And then, yeah, and then of course you get the inevitable kind of double thing of they pull off the face of like, ha ha, I'm this person, and they pull off another face and they're actually someone else, which is always a good time.
Yeah, there's a shameful admission, I read ahead, and so with multiple sets of spies basically, or people or mysterious organizations getting involved, there's a lot of counterintelligence where a person, like, you'll get someone being bugged, and then the person who's bugged knows they've been bugged because that's what you do when you're a spy, and so they will then act the fool and do a bunch of shit so the bug picks it up. Meanwhile, they're counter-programming it and getting ready that they, you know that they know that this, you know, it gets almost Death Note-ish in terms of like, ha-ha, but I thought about that. So, yeah, it's not quite as intense as Death Note or as boring at times. But, yeah, I really enjoy this, as I say, because the first chapter is like 80 pages, so it's like half the actual full volume, and it feels like it's trying to tell like a decent, like almost a whole story in that, and then thankfully like realizes it can spend a volume maybe like doing a little bit of character backstory, which is kind of the funny thing, that you learn more about like Peta and his dad and their financial problems more than any of the main characters. The most you learn about Kurama is that he has a spat with like the data fitted glasses guy on the team because of like a domestic, because they're shitty flatmates to each other. And that's the most you know about him, really, apart from just stuff he does. But again, that's one of the reasons I really like this series, is that, you know, it's laying down all this stuff and throwing out terms, and, you know, you get the sort of day by day immediate impact of these dumb things, like, you know, Botan's granddad being the honorary president of this, like, you know, private company. But at the same time, it's like, right, okay, come on, like, we got to pick up this thing, like, spy shit. And it kind of keeps moving. And that's why I really enjoy this series. And also, as I say, why I'm a bit sort of worried that it only lasted 7 volumes, because this seems like the sort of thing you could really go ham with.
Yeah, well, and
maybe
it feels...
maybe it went ham real fast.
Yeah, I know, it does. It certainly feels like that was probably not what the initial intention of the author was, because yeah, this first volume is very clear about being like, poof, there are a lot of these crystals, like, you know, it's a very clear, like, this is not like there are 7 Dragon Balls or whatever. It's like, no, they don't put an exact number on it, but it's like, there's a lot of them. So yeah, like, the fact even if you're collecting a fewer volume, that suggests that maybe it finishes a little earlier than anticipated.
Yeah, for sure. Like, the one that's involved in this story is 13.
Yeah.
And like, 13's already a pretty beefy number. Like, if you were playing Zelda and you were asked to go to 13 temples, you'd probably go, oh, fuck me, what? Padding. But yeah, I really enjoyed this series. It's also really dynamic. Like, it has a lot of really fun bits where characters basically have after images because they're doing a lot of stuff in a single panel. I mean, Botan's a ninja, so of course, like, you know, whether she's doing action and fighting or disarming someone, or gabbing a lot, or giving herself a mental breakdown in a cab, you get the multiple characters, and you get some really nice 2-page spreads of people doing dynamic cool shit. And so yeah, the dynamism and the speed of it really kind of comes through to me and makes it a very enjoyable, well, action thriller. Like, there's a lot of stuff happening and it kind of just barrels on.
Yeah, I mean, visually, yeah, like, this volume is kind of amazing, to be honest. Like, it looks really good. It always kind of, you know, everything is on model, like you say. It has a feeling of speed and dynamism to everything. It has a pretty broad range, as the series does, in terms of what it has to depict. Like, there are moments that are kind of pretty much pure horror. There are moments that are kind of comedy, like, hey, look at the silly faces. There are those kind of, you know, action scenes where, you know, Botan's doing her ninja stuff. And it does all of those incredibly well and kind of manages to make them mesh together really well. So yeah, like, that was definitely the thing that I kind of came away with. And again, you mentioned the anime adaptation. Like, I also have not seen it, but my thought from reading this volume was like, well, they couldn't make a good anime of this without, you know, some kind of crazy amount of effort put in, because it's, you know, there's a lot being asked of anybody, like, even as still images, like, it's really kind of having to pull its weight, and to animate this would be tricky. But yeah, like, it looks really great. And yeah, I mean I think the other part that I kind of maybe struggle with a little at times is, like, it does, because it has so much in it and because it's so dense, it has some real, like, constant tonal shifts where it keeps having to, like, bounce between kind of serious stuff and comedy, and it doesn't always get that right. I mean, I ironically, like, I read this immediately after watching Thor Love and Thunder, which has exactly the same problem of, like, it tries to be like, oh, like, deep storyline about terminal illness, but also, haha, look at the funny lightning man, and look at the guy with the crazy hammer. And it's like, it tries to do both of those things. It tries to be funny and it tries to be poignant, and sometimes it just, like, the tonal whiplash is too much. And this also has some moments like that where it's like, oh, you know, let's talk seriously about, like, racism and, you know, how immigrants are treated in society, but also, like, oh, look at Botan, she's making a funny face, and, you know, she's having an argument with Kulama. And it's like, you know, sometimes the fact it has to go from one to the other, like, between panels, it doesn't, it just feels a little bit jarring to me.
Yeah, I think the talk about Thor Love and Thunder, you know, it was Thor Love and Thunder. It's just those two things. You wanted Thor Love and Thunder and transitions. So, you know, that's the special edition. But yeah, like, especially when you mention the horror bit, like, when you know, you see the result of what happened to the teleporting train. It's like, oh, I was not expecting to read this. Like, this is a 2-page spread I didn't want to read while I was eating dinner. So, yeah, it kind of goes pretty hard. And then to have it be like, Botan has never been outside of her prefecture. She's got a waffle now. And it's like, okay, like, you are spies? Like, you can see why the handler's just like, fuck's sake, people, come on, like, focus on the mission. So yeah, it's got, and also like the one thing always about it is the like director of the safety department company and the fact that Botan's granddad is there as the honorary president. And it's like, I hope this really weird character director like pays off at some point, because at the moment this seems like a very important linchpin of your organization who is a comedy extra. So yeah.
Yeah, for sure. But I mean, yeah, like that whole kind of horror turn, like that was a really good just kind of drop out of nowhere that the series then kind of goes back and explains, of just like, oh yeah, like this is the reason that they kind of stuck this technology in a crystal and aren't actively using it, because yeah, has some problems, not quite perfect as it turns out. And so stuff like that I really liked about it. I like the fact that kind of the antagonists in this volume are kind of a complete mystery. Like, they kind of crop up, screw with a thing or two here and there, kind of like, you know, it's pretty clear what their agenda is, but also there's no context to like exactly what they're doing or why. And it's a really fun just sort of like shadowy organization subplot of like, oh, okay, well, these guys, it's a really good kind of set of antagonists, because it's not that usual like, we're just gonna fight everybody and win and then they lose every time. It's like, they're just quietly super competent, and like they kind of feel quite malicious, quite kind of dangerous at the end of this first volume, because they've actually done very little. They've just kind of been in the right place at the right time and then just been like, yoink, there we go, we got what we wanted. And it's like, that is way more kind of impactful than the usual, you know, kind of mustache twirling villains that think they're super smart and then never like get what they want in the end.
Yeah, they don't like sort of jump out and announce themselves. You know, it's just, we lost? What? So yeah, that's really spoilers for, well, extremely mild spoilers, but they get who they are gets revealed in volume 2. And so some of the mystery does go away, but at least the first volume, it's admirable how much the author keeps the powder dry, because it'd be so, especially when like the characters are a bit cooked, they're a bit of a funny pair, and it's like, God, it'd be so easy just to make these two like real dumb. But no, it keeps them, you know, especially because like for a first mission, you know, it finds a way to make it a good arc of like, okay, we've got to get this mission done. We've got to have setbacks as well as victories, so the series can continue and be tense, rather than just, oh, haha, we are the Ninja Girl and the Muscle Man who make faces at each other and constantly needle each other, and now we shall proceed to effortlessly collect all the MacGuffins. It's like, wow, that's boring. So the fact that there's quite a lot to do in this is much more interesting, at least myself.
Likewise. And yeah, to have, because if nothing else, usually like they have like the first mission be a success to like set them up as like, okay, well look, you know, these guys can get the job done, but to have them kind of like fail from the get-go is like, oh well, maybe you should fire these guys, because maybe they're not that great.
I don't know, man, I wouldn't try firing a ninja. Like, I'm pretty sure that, you know, they take you to an employment tribunal or just kill you, you know, ninjas.
I don't know. I suspect if you gave them like a two years worth of vouchers to a Waffle House, like Botan would be like, cool, I'm cool, I'm done being a spy now.
I wonder what garden leave would be like for a ninja. It's like, well, we can't let you go and work for one of our competitors because you're a fucking ninja. We're just thinking about modern HR and like assassins now. This is silly.
Yeah. Like, can you still be a mysterious transfer student when you're on ninja gardening leave? We will never know.
That's also a new light novel. But yeah, I really enjoyed this. As I say, I haven't watched the anime. I'm tempted to, but as you say, like the sheer amount of craft in this, like, you know, we're in Oslo, and I have not been to Oslo, to be honest, but you know, it made the place feel different enough that it's like, okay, this isn't just someone who has like drawn a Japanese city and slapped a different name on it, which, you know, admittedly sounds like a low bar, but hey, you got to do a lot of research to like convincingly make a place feel like somewhere else.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. At the very least, it had a kind of Scandinavian vibe to it. It wasn't even like, because sometimes you get your kind of like generic Europe whenever you have anything that's in this sort of like, you know, this sphere of the globe. But yeah, it did at least feel like it had kind of a sense of place to it, and yeah, all of that stuff kind of helps to sell you on it.
Yeah, so yeah, I'm probably going to continue reading this. As I say, I've already read volume two because I wanted to carry on. And yeah, it's only quote unquote only 7 volumes. So unless it does something real stupid, I'm probably going to continue reading it till the end. So it'll be in a few returning champions anyway. So it's going to pop up again.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the fact that it's 7 episodes does leave me a little bit more tempted. Like, you know, there's definitely enough stuff that I liked about this to be like, I kind of want to see more of it. But I was also very tired by the end of this first volume because it felt like I'd been through a lot. And it's like, I guess it probably settles down into a bit more of a kind of a decent pace. Cause this does feel like a series that has a lot that it has to get out the door before it can even start. You know, in terms of setting up the whole Tesla thing and all the characters and so on and so forth. So yeah, I'll maybe pick it up like and pick up some more of it, because I'm definitely like, I didn't dislike it, and like visually it was great. It's just like I just wish it had had a bit more breathing room to really sell me on some of its elements, because then it would probably have been a no-brainer.
Yeah, I gotta admit, like, sorry, a spoiler. This is not really a spoiler because it's just trying to allay fears, but I will say that volume two doesn't really slow down, but you do have more grounding and more basis because you've been on a mission already. So stakes are much, it doesn't have to cram in as much stuff while it continues moving. I think that's perhaps the problem, is not so much that a lot of stuff happens, it's that a lot of stuff happens while people have to like try and get in explanations without slowing the entire thing down to a dead stop.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, the last thing you need to do in your spy thriller is have someone turn to the camera and go, as you know, and it's like, fuck off, what is this? So, you know, you don't do, like, for example, James Bond doesn't sit down at the poker table and his opponent doesn't turn to camera and say, as you know, James Bond, I have a detonator. You know, that's, although I'm pretty sure that has happened in at least one Bond film that I've watched and turned off. So, you know, but yeah, I feel like the fact that later on it's like, yeah, you know what the fuck's going on, let's just have more action and more of these mysterious antagonists, one of which has like, I don't know, he looks like a teddy bear with freckles, quite honestly. They almost feel like they fell out of a yaoi manga, like they got lost on the way to the port to the comiket. So yeah.
Yeah, there is definitely a little bit of that kind of yaoi manga vibe for sure from some of the characters. So yeah, I don't know if that's like a thing for the artists that they've done in the past, but it certainly has a little bit of a feel. At the very least, it feels like it's kind of maybe trying to sell itself into that audience a bit to say, hey, look at these guys, huh?
Yeah, well, you know, can't hurt. Got to expand the market somehow. So, but yeah, I really enjoyed reading this. So yeah, I'm going to continue with that. But is there anything else to mention about Tesla Note?
No, nothing else from me. The only final thing I will say is that Thomas Edison needs a new PR guy, because like everybody's like, everything's all about Tesla and Edison just getting a very bad rap. Like he needs a new marketing department. That's all I'm saying.
I don't know, man. Like, frankly, Edison's marketing department was himself. Like, dude was a constant self-promoter. He was a prick. At least that, you know, all evidence points to him being an absolute prick. So, you know, but hey, all at the same time, like, I mean, you know, would you trust someone who put the super over technology in very volatile crystals that are now causing worldwide catastrophes? Maybe don't do that. You know, that seems like a bad idea.
So. Yeah, yeah. Just put them in a box somewhere. Label it clearly and we could be done. But yeah, that would be a really boring manga of just like somebody finds a box like, oh, better be careful with these, series ends.
Well, yeah, or it's just like, oh, we've opened up the year 2000 time capsule and oh no. So yeah, the only way to make a time capsule interesting, frankly, it's like, oh look, someone put their ABBA cassette in it, big whoop. Anyway, that's some Tesla Note, and now a brief break. Hey, Elliot here. Just interrupting this episode to let you know that Screen Tone Club is supported by our lovely listeners via Patreon. Doing this helps defer the cost of buying the manga we read for the show, keeps the show ad-free, and also gives us a lovely little ego boost. By supporting us on Patreon, you also get monthly bonus episodes. And if you support us on the $3 and up tier, you get to vote on what we cover on these bonus episodes. To find out more, please go to patreon.com/screentoneclub. Sign up today, and you get full access to the entire back catalogue of 2 years plus of bonus episodes. Whether you're a subscriber or not, thank you very much for listening. And now, back to the show. Right, and we're back. And so now it's our second series of the episode. Andy, take it away.
Yeah, so my pick for this episode is Your Boy Kong Meng, Volume 1, which again, on the subject of like anime adaptations, I have not watched yet, but kind of mean to, because people mostly just keep reposting the opening, which is a banger. So I was, for some reason, I hadn't even realized that this had kind of come out in English in its original manga form, but actually there's 8 volumes of it out in English already.
It's been around for a while, like it's been around the like Kodansha sales circuit a few times.
Which is kind of crazy. So yeah, it's not finished in Japan yet. Currently 10 volumes out there, like I say, 8 volumes in English, digital only, I think, currently as well. I wonder whether that will change with the seeming popularity of the anime, but we will see. But yeah, so Your Boy Kong Meng starts with the year 234 AD in China, where we get to see Zhu Jiliang, aka Kong Meng, on his deathbed. And basically his dying wish, as he kind of contemplates the life that he's lived, is that wherever he is reborn, wherever he ends up next, he just wants peace. Like, he wants to be reborn somewhere peaceful. And instead, he ends up in purgatory, he thinks, or known to us as Shibuya at Halloween, which, easy mistake to make. So given that he is kind of reborn as full-grown, like, adult, young adult Kong Meng, complete in his kind of traditional dress. He's basically
his regalia, I think.
His regalia
would be
is the phrase. Yeah.
There we go. Yeah.
So he is instantly, basically, everyone's like, man, that's a really good cosplay. That's a really good, like, fancy dress for Halloween. come drink with us. And so, not really knowing what's going on, he just kind of goes along for the ride, and ends up in a club. Where he's being plied with drink, and the thing that kind of catches his eye, or rather his ear, is the singer at this club, who is a girl named Eiko. And so he's just kind of like, wow, like, she has this incredible voice, kind of in his very, like, very ancient sort of vibe, kind of comes and tells her, like, how great she was, and she's like, okay, you're a kind of a weird dude, but thanks. And so the night continues, but by the morning, Kong Meng is basically, you know, he has nowhere to go. He's just been, like, isekai'd into this world, effectively. And so he's just kind of there hanging out. Eiko just kind of takes pity on him because, you know, he clearly has, like, nowhere to go. He's a little the worse for wear after a night out. So kind of invites him back to her place to at least kind of, you know, recuperate somewhat. And the two of them end up kind of striking up a sort of strange relationship. We get the vast majority of the fish out of water stuff out of the way, pretty much in a couple of pages from there, of Kong Meng being like, what is this smartphone you speak of? What is this humidifier? And it kind of gets all of those jokes done and dusted so that we can get to the real meat of this, which is basically Kong Meng ends up working in the club where Eiko works, kind of makes fast friends with the manager, who, as it turns out, is a big, like, Three Kingdoms nerd, and is just like, man, you know your stuff. You're cool. You're almost like the real Kong Meng.
he says, winking at the camera from behind his, like, dark shades.
Yeah, indeed. And by the end of this first volume, Kong Meng has basically become Eiko's manager, because she wants to make it, well, she wants to make it big as a singer, but also has massive, intense self-doubt that she can ever be popular and that anybody really cares. Like, you know, she's in this kind of little club where people are just there to get wasted and not really pay much attention to the music. And so this volume charmed the pants off of me, quite frankly. Like, I really enjoyed it. Like, all of the characters are kind of likable. It manages to kind of pull the dynamics of those characters along in a way that occasionally kind of stretches the believability of how people would react in this situation. But it's like, sure, you can run with it. You get some fun stuff where, you know, basically Kong Ming is this sort of master strategist. And so, of course, starts kind of trying to apply his kind of, I mean, he phrases it rather than being AK's manager, he's her tactician. And that's kind of how it works out, where he kind of finds these strategies to kind of help promote her, which are some really sort of fun moments of kind of like transplanting kind of Three Kingdoms stories into a nightclub, which is kind of bizarre. But yeah, I really like this. Mostly just like the characters kind of carry this. They're all kind of likable. You pretty quickly kind of get to see their sort of their intentions and their desires and, you know, where they've come from. Like Eiko just gets a very quick little bit of backstory about where she was at before she became a singer, which is just like, you know, very brief, very high level, but like, okay, yeah, cool. I get it. And yeah, I really like this. I definitely want to read more of it because it was just like a pretty fun read. And I'm kind of quite happy just to spend some more time with these guys.
Yeah, I feel like I really want to like this series more than I came away doing. Like, this is my second time reading it. Like, as I say, it's been on the, like, Kodansha sales circuit a few times, so I picked it up before just to kind of see what it was like and to go like, okay, fuck it, what is this damn thing that keeps appearing? And, you know, it does a lot of smart stuff to kind of like hide the seams of believability, and like everyone has massive mental fortitude to deal with the fact that like Kong Ming is walking among them, and frankly his clothing must be a nightmare to clean or keep clean, especially when he keeps going to fucking nightclubs and working there. But I feel like the thing it does like very smartly is, as you say, it gets the fish out of water stuff done with, like, he almost learns about fucking crypto very quickly, which would be a fucking disaster if, like, you know, one of the smartest military strategist minds of, you know, humankind got into fucking crypto garbage. So, oof, bullet dodged. I feel like, yeah, there is a core and a heart to this series that I really want to like, but I feel like every time it's not quite there, where, you know, reading it a second time especially, like, Eiko's a really nice character, like, as you say, is completely undermined by issues of self-worth and self-doubt, and the fact that, you know, when her backstory is short but extremely poignant and doesn't need to over-egg the pudding, because it's like, oh okay, that's your backstory, and that makes perfect sense, and also, wow, you've been through a lot, and so that's really cool. And also Eiko is the kind of person who kind of gets taken advantage of by other assholes in the music industry, like, but the problem is, of course, that it uses that exact same strategy twice, even in this first volume, of like Eiko kind of getting fucked over by someone else, and then, you know, Zhu Xiang finding a way to kind of like strategize his way out of it and turn it into a complete victory, which does feel a bit too much at times. And also, like, it tips its hat way too quickly by saying, oh, here is this strategy I used, you know, 50 pages later, aha, I use the same strategy. And it's like, okay, like, yes, that's clever, but also you've completely kind of like shot your shot twice now. That's a bit weird. Also, this seems like a massive fire code violation, but hey, we've got to all suspend disbelief for something, don't we? And yeah, like, I feel like the one thing that would make me buy this series was just if Kong Ming put on a fucking like shirt and tie or something, like, so he wasn't walking around in his entire panoply with his fucking feather boa fit, his feather fan thing. But, you know, again, that's probably part of the charm, is the fact that you've got this extremely sharp and, you know, all we have to go on are descriptions in Three Kingdoms and art of the time to know what he maybe looked like. And so it's like, well, let's make him look real fucking attractive as like a middle-aged dude who is very smart. But back to my original point I meant to get to before I went on a whole big rambling thing is, yeah, the author has realized and smartly deploys the fact that, yeah, he was smart. Like, Kong Ming was a smart tactician. He was a smart user and appraiser of people. And he is now transplanted into the real world with all of his knowledge of his long life and adventures. And now can basically be like, okay, well, that was real fucking strange. I thought I was in hell for a night. And I kind of was. Like, he even does the whole Shibuya meltdown thing by being collapsed against a transformer or an air conditioning unit, which, I want to quickly note, has STC written on the side. So, hey, it's us! us. But yeah, he quickly adapts, and because he is smart, it's like, okay, yeah, he can just fucking deal. He can roll with this shit. Like, you know, he doesn't quite know what's going on here, but hey, you know, there's no point worrying about it. So let's get on with this, like, adventure, helping this girl, like, not be destroyed by even low level music promotion. So yeah,
I'm curious to see how and where it goes with the, like, the strategy side of things, because I feel like I certainly gave the fact that it sort of it flags what it's going to do well in advance as a, like, okay, this is like the first one of these, so this almost feels like, you know, the first puzzle in the book where they give you the solution so that you know how this is going to go from then on.
It's and a tutorial where it tells you what to do. Yeah,
basically. And yeah, like, you do the thing, it checks the tick boxes, you get some XP, and you move on to actual challenges. So yeah, like, I kind of definitely gave it a fair amount of rope in terms of that stuff. But yeah, I think I kind of just like the fact that it leans quite hard into its absurdity, and, like, you know, every character is just like, what's the deal with this dude, and somebody just gives some very throwaway, like, explanation from it, or he just goes full ham on just like, well, I am a master tactician, and everyone's just like, okay, cool, let's move on. And that's just the bit, and I kind of like that, because I think there is, like, a genuine honesty to that of just like, look, you're having, like, a business meeting or whatever, someone's super weird, they give some super weird explanation as to who they are, and they're just like, okay, cool, I'm just gonna carry on. And
yeah, we'll... I don't have enough life to waste it doing this. Like, you as the reader don't have time to read the same gag, and the author does not want to rewrite the same thing, and in the world of this, it's like, we're in the music industry, people are fucking weird, let's just move on. Like, come on, what's going on here?
Yeah. And I like, kind of, you know, I like the music setting of it. Like, I think that's kind of a really fun sort of core conceit for it, which, again, and one of the really useful things about having kind of Kong Ming as a central character is it makes sense when there's exposition about BPM and stuff like that, because it's like, obviously you're not going to have to deal with the average person in a club and explain to them, like, BPM or how a music set works and how you hype people up and then calm them down and hype them up again, but this is all stuff that, like, it makes sense as exposition to, like, set the scene, and it kind of, like, that all fits. But yeah, it's mostly just there to be fun. It does have a very male-gazy eye on all of its characters, which is kind of is kind of infuriating at times. Again, especially around Aiko, it's like, I mean, how many times does she get changed in her apartment, like, the first night there? Like, about three or four times.
That is legit, like, the second thing I have written down is, like, is she constantly changing outfits? And also, like, why do characters find a way to point their bum directly at the panel? Like, it's just like, check out this bum. And it's like, yeah, bums are good. But, like, what the fuck? Like, this is weird. Please don't expose it while then taking up half a page with this lady's toned ass. Like, it's just kind of funny where it just feels like, you know, the artist is just grabbing it and just turning the rudder towards, you know, booty town.
Yeah. It's one of those things that is almost sort of, like, comically overdone in terms of, like, yeah, posing, etc., because it's like, yeah, people don't shower like that, etc. It's just like, you know, these are not, like, natural positions to stand in at any point in your life, but yeah here we are. So yeah, that kind of stuff, you know, can be a little bit tiring, like, especially because, you know, there's a lot of Aiko in this series. Like, she is the other main character. She's super important. And the fact that the series is constantly finding ways to, like, make her, like, even she's just sitting on a chair in the bar and, you know, she's just perching and the camera is pointed in such a way that it's like, oh, look at her, isn't she sexy? And it's like, you don't need to do this. She can be attractive without having to be, like, perched and posed like this. Just let her be her. Especially because she's not a character that has airs and graces around. It's entirely the point is, like, she doesn't really see herself as anything special, so it kind of, like, you know, even the way she dresses generally, like, she's not really dressing up, she's kind of, like, pretty casual, and so it just feels sort of doubly weird that they then try to make that into a thing, and it's like, nah, this does not really need to be here.
Yeah, plus, like, she's wearing, like, lounge and club wear. Like, she's, you know, the way that the series kind of morphs the fact that she's sat on a bar stool wearing a hoodie into, like, oh, oh, look at that, a bit of shoulder. And it's like, no. Also, like, Eiko for me is not that kind of character. Like, she is, you know, she is the little chick you want to see fly out of the nest. You know, the whole point is that, you know, she has talent and, you know, Kong Ming especially likes her and I think she has a great singing voice. And it's like, well, he, you know, it's a raising series almost. It's like, hey, we want to see you flourish. Like, I don't want to see your ass. Like, I mean, sure, maybe once in a while, but like, I don't want fan service. I want her to prosper. Like, it's this weird combination of like, no, this is not what I want from this character in this series. Like, you've got a bit of a mismatch in what you're doing with this character here. Like, yeah. Don't do that.
Yeah, and I think that's the other thing that is almost impossible for this series to do, and I'm kind of curious as to how well the anime adaptation manages it in terms of actually putting across like that Eiko's a good singer, because it's like this, you know, we don't get to see any actual lyrics, we don't really get a feel of like what she's singing, and I feel like it could just do with a little bit more color around the edges there to be like, because even like the other sort of main singer that we see in this volume, like you get very clear, oh, she covers Rihanna songs, and it's like that feels like a very like referential throwaway, but it also gives you like a kind of grounding of like, okay, I can kind of, my mind's eye, I can imagine how this singer sounds and kind of what her vibe is. Like Eiko, I really have no idea. Like, she could sound like Alvin and the Chipmunks. I have literally no way of knowing, and you've not given me any kind of grounding on like what it is that she sings and why she sounds so good. And it's a really difficult question to answer in a non kind of like audio form, but I feel like it needs something, whether it's some sparkles around her, whatever, just something to kind of put that across beyond just Kongmin being like, hey, you're real good. Because like, maybe he's, I mean, that would be like the plot twist at the end of this, turns out like he's actually tone deaf and she is actually no good at singing, because like, you know, he's the only one, well, I guess the manager does as well, to be fair, but like, you know, you don't ever get that kind of, I don't ever get that feeling of like, oh man, this is someone who's really good.
Yeah, I must admit, I feel like you've kind of nailed it there. Like I said, I was really wanting to like this series, but there was something missing. And I think that is the, like, the hook part that's missing, where, you know, Kong Ming does some useful stuff, but doesn't quite, you know, he has strategies, but doesn't have the killer sort of like bullet in the chamber, pull the trigger sort of like killer app to it. And the same thing with Eiko, like you see 2-page spreads of her singing and, you know, it's manga, it's a visual medium, but having a 2-page spread of her on stage dressed as an oni singing is like, that's cool, but I don't quite get the impression of what is so captivating apart from her, apart from the fact this dude just got super fucking isekai'd and then force-fed tequila by a dude in a Frankenstein costume, which frankly is a good Friday night. But yeah, the thing is that there's a lot of cases here where it's like, well, you've got the setup here, but you haven't mashed them together with the bit of glue that kind of keeps it together. And as I say, like, the one thing about this series in particular is at the end of it, it's like, oh, we're doing a rerun of the first, like, conflict arc where it's like, oh, look, another band appears to be trying to fuck her over again. And it's like, well, you know, you did that already. You need to show something else here, really. I mean, hell, like, you know, I'd rather have Kong Ming do, like, you know, like music promotion rather than, like, I don't know, be drafted in for the War on Fucking Terror. That's an entirely separate series that should not exist. But yeah, I feel like you saying that is the right thing, where like, you need like another piece of texture or people reacting, say like, oh no, like she is good, like she is in this little place and, you know, she has a reason to stay there, but we need like the, oh, she's like X, or she makes me feel like Y, and it's like, okay, like there we are, I have something to grab onto, like you say about the Rihanna covers. Like, Rihanna is a powerful vocalist and a very good singer, and it's like, I know the shape of what makes that, draws people into that.
Yeah. And it's like, even it has the opportunity with that kind of like, you know, first strategy that Kong Ming deploys, where it's like, you know, people get kind of drawn into the room where Eiko's singing, and it makes the effort of like having panels of people being like, oh, well, we can't really figure out how to get out of here, but also, hey, this girl's pretty good. But that's kind of all you get. You don't get anything beyond that of just like, oh, like, you know, we don't want to leave now. It's kind of, it's a very sort of wishy-washy, oh, but also she's good. And it's like,
Yeah, you're entirely right. Like, because people go there for like the one free drink, or I can't figure out where the exit is, or, oh man, where is everything? But at the same time, it's like, and people say like, oh, Eiko's pretty good. And it's like, yeah, but you need another line. Like, you need a line after that, because it's a manga. Like, we can't hear what she's singing and what her, like, because we've had a decent amount of, like, as you say, like, music theory of how to hype people up and bring people down, but you don't get anything like that. Like, I don't want, like, a sidebar with, like, the BPM of the current moment, almost like freaking like a watch on like a watch or something, you know, some sort of Apple Watch app. But I need to know, or I feel like I'd like to know what it is that's grabbing these people about Eiko, because although, you know, we have it on word that she is good, but it's missing that another step of like, ah, okay, here we are, and this is how the strategy is helping her. Because otherwise it just seems like he's showing off. Which, yeah, you know, is the point of it, is to show off like, aha, this guy is smart and helping her, and here is this Three Kingdoms lore. But at the same time, it's like, yeah, but you need to have the application and the payoff. Although the payoff just seems to be, oh, fuck, my Instagram is blowing up.
Yeah, well, and I think that's the thing, and that's also, you know, kind of ties back into what I like about the series, is that I feel like this is not a series that is set up just to be, like, Kong Ming's story. It's not just, yeah, like, he is the genius that makes everything succeed. Like, he sets himself up as, like, I'm just your kind of, like, right-hand man here. Like, I'm not the big story here. You are, to Eiko. Like, that's his pitch, and so you need that side of it to follow through. It can't be kind of, you know, Kong Ming saves the day every time. Like, she has to have her hook, and it gets halfway there, but not quite all of the way there. And it is weird because, like I say, it names drops Rihanna. All you really need to do is just to name drop somebody for Eiko. Like, you know, whether it's Celine Dion, Kate Bush, Smash Mouth, whatever. Just, like, give people something that they can, like, go off of the back of. And then, you know, that's it. You've kind of done the job really simply there. But as it is, it's just, like, it's just a little bit wishy-washy.
Man, Andy, you've just booked the most cursed music festival I've ever heard. Do you want to add Rick Astley to that while we're at it? Like, why actually, not? I have a friend who has seen them. He's seen Rick Astley live multiple times and swears that he is extremely good live.
Yeah, so it goes, apparently, yeah.
Yeah, apparently he's a consummate showman. I mean, maybe Eiko's a consummate showman, but we don't know that because the most we get of her are either distant shots of her on stage, her working the bar, her teaching Kong Ming how to use an iPhone, or her in a cool two-page spread. But no, there's no reinforcement. That's the word I've been looking for.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. Like, as I say, like, I want to talk about this more because it looks cool. Like, Shibuya looks cool. The people look good. They look like humans. Like, Eiko's a bit more sort of gremlin-y at times, and a bit like, I think, like, Eiko is the single character who is the most anime girly, where sometimes she slips into, like, almost like stereotypical big eyes mode. And it's like, whoa, there's one panel in particular towards the end of the volume where I'm like, oh, fuck, like, she looks like she huffed too much Moe gas. And now she almost looks like she's from Clannad or something. But then it thankfully calms down. It has to calm down because otherwise her bum wouldn't be pronounced to draw. But yeah, I want this series to have that one little thing just to get its claws into me. And I watched the first episode of the anime, and it was nice and it looked nice, but also was a bit too slow. And frankly, at the time I was reading it, I had other shit I should have been doing. So it couldn't, you know, it didn't quite grab me enough to make me procrastinate with it, if that makes sense. In fact, I was actually using it to procrastinate watching other anime I should have been watching. So, you know, this is a look into the mind of Elliot Page, chronic idiot. So sorry, listeners.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I'm definitely, like, you know, I'm going to check out more of it because, like, I do generally sort of like it and I like the cast. I do worry that, yeah, it's going to fall into kind of a rut and it's just going to kind of keep doing the same thing over and over, which, you know, is a danger to it. But I'm at least willing to give it feels like it at least deserves another kind of volume or two from me to see, you know, whether it kind of keeps going or whether it just runs out of road. But yeah, like, definitely some caveats to it, but it was just one of those, like, I just had a fun time, and sometimes that's all you can ask.
Yeah, I must admit, actually, I was going to be a bit more down on this because I was, you know, after reading it the first time, I was like, why do people care about this? And then reading it the second time with a slightly more open mind was like, oh, yeah. And, you know, please see previous half an hour of discussion for my sort of attempts to get it to try and have it grab me. But also, like, I also at the end, it has like four panel skip manga. And if all else fails, I would probably read more of that, because comedy, like, you know, ancient Chinese, well, you know, historic Chinese tactician takes on estate agent is a pretty funny, like, mashup. Also, some of the best faces is watching this, like, estate agent try and be polite and not lose a sale while realizing that maybe you should not bother, and this sale is way more effort than you are really bargaining for. That was a real funny bit, just because it's like, wow, the person who drew this had a lot of fun making this estate agent look real fucking pissed. So, yeah. Hey.
Yeah, that is the enjoyable thing out of that, for sure. And it's sort of, it's kind of weird, because, like, the series itself, like, it's not that it's not a comedy at all. Like, it has jokes, but it's not really a gag comedy. Like, it kind of, it's a sitcom, really. Like, it is very, like, situational. And, like, it's pretty good at doing that. Like, it's one of those things that it's never really laugh out loud, but it kind of made me smile a decent few times. I mean, you know, again, the aforementioned, like, blockchain thing was a, like, I don't know how, like, ripped from the headlines moment that was, but it's like, okay, I can kind of appreciate that. But there are lots of kind of good, enjoyable little moments like that. And then it kind of, you know, puts its serious, quote-unquote, strategy face on, which is, like, also not very serious. It's almost playing it straight because it knows how ridiculous it is. And so all of that, like, just makes it sort of entertaining without ever being really laugh-out-loud funny.
Yeah, it doesn't really need to make, like, big gags. You know, it kind of, you know, as I said, the one thing that's really nice about it, because it's about strategy, and, you know, you're not trying to, like, beat people up. So it's not like an action series, but, you know, the fact that you're using strategy to get your way means that you can have the main character throw their arms wide and go, "Behold the beautiful prison I have made." And you go, "Huh, that's pretty funny. Check it out." Like, that's the, yeah, he did the thing. And everyone's really impressed, or horrified. And it's like, yeah, that's cool. Like, it's as you say, sitcom, except in this case, the person is making a situation based on an ancient battle. What? So yeah. That's the sort of stuff I can get down with, quite honestly.
Yeah, I mean, I would like to see a sequel where Kung Ming ends up, like, working at IKEA, and because, I mean, I feel like they are also very good at designing that kind of prison from which you cannot escape. But I mean, that I think that's maybe, like, also why I kind of get a little bit out of this, is, like, it is kind of like the promotion and marketing angle. Like, given that that's my job, it's like, yeah, you know what? I've designed booth spaces before, and that's kind of, you don't play quite those kind of tricks, but, like, you want to make sure that you get people to the bits of the booth that you want to get them to. Yeah. And there is a certain kind of ancient strategy to that, albeit not from, like, the Three Kingdoms. So I think I could kind of appreciate where it was going with that as well.
Yeah, for sure. Like, it's like, oh, okay, I have got an aim in mind, and I need to know what I need to do to reach that aim. Like, the last thing you need to do in a booth is to make people confused about where they should be looking.
Yeah.
It's like when you see shitty PowerPoints, and it's like, I don't know where the fuck I'm looking on this thing, and I don't want to look at it. Like, I'm just going to turn away from the Teams meeting now. Because you're going to recite the entire fucking thing anyway, because you've written all your notes on the slides. Don't do that, kids. I thankfully learned that at a young age. Don't do that. It sucks. God, it's one of those moments that it makes you think, like, wow, university really is a fucking scam that I paid X thousand pounds to watch this dude read his slides in front of you. God, I'm getting really intense all of a sudden. I don't know where that came from. But it's nice. It is nice. And yeah, as I say, like, if it can build up Aiko a bit more and, you know, kind of bring her into the wider world of what she wants to do, that's cool. Because as you said earlier, and I let it slip a bit, is that, you know, Kong Ming isn't out there going, right, let's get you a record deal. He's like, I will help you, but you have to be the one to decide what you want to accomplish. And I, as your faithful retainer, will attain that for you if I can humanly help it. And it's like, yeah, that's cool. That's super sweet. And also it really calls to mind, like, old court politics of, like, hey, if I go off on my own, I'm probably going to get executed because I might do something that I don't like, and then we're all fucked. So there you go.
Yeah, so yeah, I think much like yourself with Tesla Note, like, this will probably be a returning champion for me at some point, and we will revisit how it progresses and see how it goes.
Yeah, also, I'm just kind of glad that, like, the Fate universe continues to expand, because, hey, Zhu Xiliang is also in Fate. Check it out. But, yeah, no, it's, that was one of my moments of, like, where have I heard of this name before? Oh, fuck, it's Fate. Oh, God, help. I am forever lost. So yeah, good fun. At least Zhuge Liang stayed the same gender this time. Oh god, they put female Merlin in Fate Go. What the fuck? I mean, it's Merlin. Merlin can do whatever the fuck they like. Also, like, that's an easy way to make infinite money off of gacha nerds. So hey, anyway, I'm tangenting again. Unless you've got anything else, Andy?
No, that's it from me.
Right, let's talk about what we're talking about next time. So next episode, I've picked something that is light and quite easy to read, but at the same time I picked this, I bought this for a laugh thinking, haha, wouldn't this be fun to read? And then halfway through I was like, oh shit, I really like this, I want to talk about it on the podcast to explain why and explore it. So my pick is volume one of I'm a Wolf But My Boss Is a Sheep. And Andy, how about you?
Yeah, well, first of all, I'm glad you picked that, because that's sort of been kicking around my, like, ah, maybe someday this will get on my list thing, so at least now I have a reason to read it. And yeah, my pick is, I know very little about it, but I like read the synopsis as it's a new release and it sounded fascinating, so I slapped it on the document. So my pick for the next episode is Correspondence from the End of the Universe, Volume 1.
Yeah, I did the exact same thing. I bought it this morning before I looked at the document, because I was like, fuck it, that sounds interesting. And here we are. So yeah, we'll read those and we'll talk to you, dear listeners, about what we think about them. So, moving into close down, thank you so much for listening. I feel like we had pretty high energy, so maybe that transfers to you through this episode. If you want to use that energy, you can find our other podcasts at screentone.club. You can also follow us on Twitter at screentoneclub, where I have been hijacking it to make people try and read Sweat and Shut Soap, which I think is Screentone Club approved, question mark. Yeah, sure, why not? You can also find us on Patreon, as mentioned earlier. Even from $1 a month, you get all of our previous bonus episodes. And also, for a little bit more, you can vote on what we cover in said bonus episodes. So you too can make us read vending machine light novels. As has already been done, quite honestly. Whoops. Actually, J Novel Club announced a new light novel. It's about being an apple. Someone reincarnates as an apple, which seems like it would be a very short shelf life. Oops. Sorry for the pun. Anyway, moving into, like, well, let's just get out of this closed down before I go completely doolally. My name is Elliot Page. I have been drinking a tin of Iron Brew energy drink. Don't do that. I'm far too excited. You can find me at Elliot Page on Twitter, posting cat pictures as per. And Andy, how about you?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Hannahs1979.
Cool. So yeah, from both of us, thank you so much and good night.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.